Welcome back to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Linda Hutzel Manning, novelist, playwright, writer of non-fiction, and poet. Unfortunately, we don't have time to discuss everything, so we won't be able to talk about her poetry today. But before we move on to your new project, Linda, I want to ask you about your novella, Heads I Win, which won the Quattro 2014 novella competition. Very briefly, what is a novella?
Okay, well, Quattro Books qualified it as 20,000 to 40,000 words. Now, I don't know whether that's dyed in the wool or whether that's just what they wanted. Mm. I had a longish short story that I'd never gotten published. They were looking for something that was unusual, intense. I forget the words he used, and I remembered this short story, and I got all excited about it. So I went home, and then there was only, I think, about 15 days till the deadline. So I worked about 12 hours a day. My dear, long-suffering husband took over and did everything, and I just OD'd on this manuscript. And when I submitted it, I thought, you know, so there goes. I wasn't expecting anything, really.
What is it about?
I say it's magic realism. It's about this librarian. It's set on the West Coast, and she's married to her university professor. He's older than she is, and they've had a rather staid relationship in their marriage, but everything is fine, and she's quite happy, and he's suddenly in a very bad car accident and become a quadriplegic. And he completely changes personality. He's petulant, he's demanding, he's nasty to her. And she has a housekeeper that comes during the week, and she's a librarian. And so you cut into the story when he has already had this accident and is extremely difficult. And I just need to read the beginning of it, if I can, to let you know. I mean, what happens is totally preposterous and unbelievable. But
it must have been convincing.
I guess it won the
competition.
Well, it was shortlisted. Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen. We are going to let you read from that. But
okay.
Before we do that, I know the working title of your new project is One Room School Teacher, 1963 to 65.
Yeah, that's kind of only the working title. Yeah,
right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Can you tell us about your plans for the book? And will it be a memoir or have a wider focus?
I don't even know yet. I think what I want to do is I want to begin at the beginning. I want to sort of say what was a very few things that were going on in the world in 1963, then a few things that were going on in Ontario, like front edge things, and then in Cobourg, and then there was us, Little House on the Prairie. It was a complete time warp. The school was a complete time warp. It had seen better days by the time I was there, and at the end of the first year, we found out that the school would be closed at the end of the second year in 1965. That's when they closed almost all the one-room schools in southern Ontario. I don't think I was even aware there were one-room schools in southern Ontario, but there were quite a few of them. So it was this little school on the side of the road between Cobourg and Port Hope, two chemical toilets in the back, no storm windows, one cold water tap, and a wood stove. And one of the parents came early every morning and started the fire, and that was it. And there were precious few books, and the pencil sharpener ate the pencils. And
it had some advantages, do you think, or not?
Oh, yes. I mean, there were about 30 kids, and they were like family, because there were only about 11 family groups, but there mm-hmm. were, you know. So the Burnham family, who were there, the year that I started teaching, apparently you had been able to have your children attend a town school if they had property in town, but lived in the country. And in 1963, I don't know whether the schools were getting more crowded, they suddenly reversed that decision and said you had to be living in the town of Cobourg to have your children going to school there. The Burnham children, the four of them, were going to Burnham School, which was named after them. So they were less than happy about being stuck out in this one-room school. But now, bless Kathy. Kathy Burnham, I get to talk to her at the Y quite a bit. She says it was the best 2 years they ever spent in school. What saved me was that I had attended a two-room school. Baltimore was a two-room school, and I attended that in grades 6, 7, and 8, in the late 40s, early 50s. And I remembered what she did, how she coped, how she organized things. And if I hadn't, I would have really been in a bad way, because what I had to do was go at about 7:30 in the morning and put seat work on 3 blackboards all the way around the 3 sides of the room. That was enough to keep everybody busy. And then when they came in, I would start teaching, starting with grade 1. I would teach, and then I would have to switch and then try to get something for the grade 1. You know, it was a huge amount of work, huge. I spent about 4 hours a night during the week, and about 15 hours on the weekend getting stuff ready for it.
Yes, I think that one-room school teachers were very dedicated.
Yeah.
Very dedicated.
I mean, I was creative, and I did a whole lot of stuff with the kids, and I remember I was really, really strict with them when I first got there, because I thought, you know, this is it. It's sink or swim. So I wouldn't even let them move, and of course you could do that in those days. And then I lightened up, and then everything was fine. You know, everything was good. We had a great time. We really did have a great time. So I have this scrapbook from the first year, and that's going to help me considerably. And I have a list of all the students, which is also helpful. I went to see the Fourth Line show maybe 3 years ago about a one-room school. I thought it was set in the 1800s somewhere here, and I thought, not that much different from what I was doing in the 60s. I mean, there's only certain things you can do in a one-room school situation, right?
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, read us some more from your novella.
Okay. What Anne notices first are the 2 little piles of dust, and an instant later the empty wheelchair footrests. She blinks, thinking she must be seeing things, assuming to see what should be there. Harold's wrinkled feet, yellowed toenails. Her head is under the table, bending down to pick up the teaspoon she dropped when he jerked his arm again, all the while listening to him mumble it was an accident. Certain he's frowning, one black eyebrow raised, piercing blue eyes fixed on her. He's in one of his moods this morning, she thinks numbly. Another long weekend ahead. Hurry up, Anne, will you? My feet are cold. Anne bangs her head on the kitchen table as she stands up. You almost spilled the milk. Sorry. Do you want the rest of your cereal? I told you, my feet are cold. I'll get your socks and my slippers. Anne leans against the bedroom dresser, sweat running down between her shoulder blades. Morning sun pours in, zigzagging a crazy design on the delicately patterned wallpaper. Less than an hour ago, she lifted those lifeless feet squarely onto the footrests, noticed his toenails needed cutting. You're in overload, she says to herself, pulling open the dresser drawer and yanking out a clean pair of socks. Things have been hectic all week at the library, and she hasn't had time to recover. She grabs his plaid slippers from under the bed and hurries back to the kitchen. The clock ticks out of sync with Harold's raspy breathing. Friday, when Anne arrived home, Mrs. Forster, the housekeeper, beckoned Anne outside, saying hurriedly that Harold's breathing had been increasingly rough the last couple of days. Anne hopes they're not in for another bout of pneumonia. My corn pops are all mushy now, Harold snaps. What took you so long? Anne inhales sharply, thinks of slamming the slippers down on the table beside him, but doesn't. She maneuvers the wheelchair back and toward her. Harold's legs, covered with a wool blanket, hang passively in front. She's sure now she imagined it. She hasn't. Where his feet were less than an hour ago, nothing. She lifts one pant leg to find the bottom of his ankle curved round, the skin taut and shiny. Shaking, she tries to pull the socks over each stump until she stops, gagging involuntarily. My slippers, he reminds her. When Mrs. Forrester is here, she always puts them on before breakfast. I didn't notice the holes in these socks, she manages to say, snatching them up. I'll get another pair. Well, hurry, will you? My feet are like ice. Back in the bedroom, she sits on the bed and tries to stop shaking, wonders if she's becoming delusional. As if it were yesterday, she remembers a particular psychology class, all of them keen and much too arrogant, the professor talking about after effects of unexpected trauma, how the mind, in a state of disbelief, uses coping mechanisms, one of which is to simply go along with the situation as if it were perfectly normal. She stands numbly and opens the dresser drawer. Another memory follows, a first aid course she took a couple of years ago, where the instructor said amputees frequently have feeling in a missing limb. Steadying herself momentarily against the dresser drawer, she stuffs each sock with three or four other pairs. Harold glowers when she returns to the kitchen. "I've changed my mind," he says. "I want toast." "First things first," she says brightly, reaching down to pull on the socks. "This will only take a minute." Even though scrunching the socks into the slippers is tricky, the final results seem quite respectable. She feels like some other version of herself, tougher, unexpectedly resilient. While making the toast at the counter, she again eyes the two little piles of dust under the table. They look harmless enough, like something accidentally spilled, sand down from the beach, perhaps. "Isn't it almost time for Oprah?" Harold asked. "Mrs. Forrester always..." "It's Saturday morning, Harold. There's nothing on but cartoons." "Well, hurry up. I'm probably missing the best ones." Anne watches the back of his head in front of the TV. Today, Harold's feet must be the least of her worries. She's not going to start feeling sorry for herself, for her life and what it's come to. There simply isn't time. Laundry first and then a dinner party to plan. This month it's her turn. Harold University colleagues have been more than generous since his car accident. Head-on collision coming around a curve. Three teens in a small sedan, dead by the time anyone arrived at the scene, scattered like tossed luggage outside the vehicle. Harold's Audi Sport had good airbags, resilient frame. Otherwise, it would have been four dead.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you. Oh, dear. Now I have to read the end. So, you're going to be very busy with research for quite a while. We hope you enjoy that. And
I
look
will.
Forward to hearing you read about your one-room schoolhouse and its place in the educational system next time you come to Word on the Hills.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Coburg author Linda Hutzel Manning. You can buy Linda's books at any bookstore and also, of course, online at Amazon and Indigo. I believe a number of your books have recently been issued as e-books. Is that right, Linda?
Yeah, the two children's time travel novels that were with Kato.
And listeners, if you would like to connect with us with comments, queries or suggestions for whom we might interview in future programs, please leave your comment at our website, www.wordonthehills.com. If you've missed a program or would like to listen to one again, you'll find all our broadcasts archived at the website too. You can listen to them anytime and from anywhere. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you'll join us for another program next week, right here on Word on the Hills. Sunday at 1 p.m. and Thursday at 1 a.m. for those of you who are up late. See you next week.